What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for this week's Know Your Foe episode. We're going to be talking about the New England Patriots coming to town for that Sunday night game. Joining us to do that is our old friend, Mark Schofield. Mark, how you been doing?
I've been doing well, Ken. It's been a while, but excited to be back. We got a fascinating game to talk about. Two teams that, you know, obviously are in the AFC playoff picture. Obviously, two teams that really need to win a football game here this weekend. Mm-hmm. And I think that's reflected with the fact, and you and I were just talking about this game could flex to Sunday night. And so I was thinking about trying to get up to M&T for this one, but I don't do Sunday nights outside in December. So I'm probably going to be watching this one from the couch, but excited for this one. It should be a fantastic game and excited to dive into it with you today.
If this were a playoff game, would you feel differently about it, even a night game?
Playoff game, I'd probably get the Under Armour cold weather gear out and get out there for it because, you know, you don't get a chance to see playoff games in the flesh too often here. So I would probably change things up for that. But regular season Sunday night, headed into a holiday week with the kids, you know, excited about school and the holiday and everything. Got some things I got to take care of instead.
Understood. A great year, obviously a big step up in division, finally cracking the Bills stranglehold on it. Talk about that a little bit.
It's been a fascinating year. It's been an incredible year so far here through 15 weeks of the NFL season. And I think, you know, Patriots fans probably are of mixed mind of it. And I'm, as we'll get to here in a second, also becoming of mixed mind of it. But coming into this year, Ken, really, you know, if you would ask me, say, in June, July, you know, what are your hopes, dreams, expectations for this Patriots season? And I would have said two things that I want to see in December. First, when we get to December football, when I turn on a CBS or a Fox broadcast or whatever, and they show that lovely little playoff picture graphic on the screen, I want to see the Patriots at least in that third column, that in the hunt column, right? Mm-hmm. If they're still playing meaningful games in December, I'm happy. Well, they're in the first column. They're a division leader here as we enter week 16, and they still have an outside shot at the number one seed. They still have a good shot, although they can't clinch it this week, of winning the AFC East. And like you said, breaking up that Bill stranglehold on the division. And so in that respect, this season has surpassed my wildest expectations. And the other thing that I really wanted to see, Ken, was when we get to that December time period, as we are in right now, am I convinced that Drake May is the guy, or at least can be the guy? I think we've checked that box as well. He's an MVP candidate. He's put up MVP type numbers. He may win the MVP, although if I had an official vote, I have one for the Pro Football Writers Association, it'd probably go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But I still think he's in that conversation, which again checks that box sort of beyond your wildest hopes, dreams, and expectations. But things and expectations do change. We're in a year where the AFC is wide open. Chiefs are eliminated. Bengals have been eliminated. Bills obviously are still a force to contend with.
But we'll be Ravens, playing on the road.
Ravens obviously a team to be to contend with in the AFC. But the conference is wide open this year. Mm-hmm. and opportunities to make a deep playoff run aren't guaranteed. You know, I have two examples in mind. If you ask a Commanders fan right now, and, you know, here we are in the DMV area, ask a Commanders fan how they were feeling after the NFC Championship game loss to the Eagles, they probably would have said, yeah, things are fine. This was a dream season. We'll be back next year. Jaden Daniels, year two, it's going to be great. Year three, it's going to be even better. Like, we're on the upward trajectory. They're eliminated from the playoffs this following season. Ask a Dolphins fan after they lose to the Niners in that Super Bowl about Marino. He'll be back, right? This is just the start of something great. They never got back, right?
That was his second season, 1984.
That was his second season. And Dolphins fans were probably thinking this is the start of something huge, and they never got back. He never got back. And so, yes, you have that sense in one part of your mind that you're playing with house money. You didn't expect to be here. It's surpassed your wildest expectations. But on the other side, you know, the other side to that coin is there's an incredible opportunity here, and they could make a run. There's a chance to make a run. You don't want to see them squander that opportunity because you never know when the next one will come. And so it's been a fascinating year. It's been an incredible season. It's been, you know, it's like I said, it surpassed my expectations, what they were back, say, in June and July. But the expectations, I think, have changed. The hopes of what this season could become have changed. And Sunday night is going to play a big role in whether those hopes and dreams can be realized.
It's certainly a litmus test on Sunday because it's a pretty good football team that the Ravens present. It's a road game, so those are a couple of factors. DVOA is not buying in. They're also, by the way, not buying into the Ravens at this point. So my question is, you know, obviously a lot of that is schedule related and playing kind of a weaker AFC East schedule. Even the Bills, you know, certainly not the team they've been in the past, but Miami, you know, despite some recent pretty good play, has not been good, and the Jets have not been good. And if you look at the schedule generally for the Patriots, it's one of the weaker ones in the NFL by DVOA comparisons. Are you on the same page there? You're talking about a deep playoff run, and I'm wondering, have they proven enough right now that they're ready to go in the playoffs? I mean, they're going to make it, obviously, and hopefully they're going to be a home team and knock the Bills out of the number two spot. But is this a team that what's your level of confidence in a first round victory versus, say, the Houston Texans?
See, I'm so glad you framed it that way, yeah. Ken, because something that I've been working through in my mind, and maybe this is some sort of like self-rationalization, coping mechanism with that loss. Wouldn't you rather be the five in the AFC this year and avoid, say, Houston in the first round? Because that is a Houston Texans defense I do not want to see any time in the playoffs, whether I'm a Patriots fan or a fan of any other team. If you fall to the five and you get Pittsburgh or Baltimore, even if it's on the road, I'd almost rather go that route. Yeah. But, you know, go ahead.
I just thought that I think the three seed might be ideal in the AFC. I'm not really buying into Denver either. There's a lot of weakness. I mean, it's just the whole point of having a wide open conference is that the one and two seeds are just not particularly great. Denver is going to have to win one game at home to get the AFC championship, but they could easily lose that if it's Buffalo, say, in the second round that they're playing. I think the three seed could end up playing at home in the AFC championship this year. I don't think that's a stretch.
That's exactly right.
That could be the Patriots. Yeah. If they get caught
Could be. And it's such an interesting year because, again, well, you have the Chiefs on the outside and already eliminated. Like, the pathways are open for teams, perhaps teams from the three, the five, the six, who knows, the seven, even with Houston with that defense, to make deep playoff runs. But to sort of spin it back to the original genesis here of the Patriots, you know, I'm not convinced that they can make a deep playoff run. I'm cognizant of the schedule that they played. Look, one of the things I do every Monday morning at SBNation.com is the updated draft order based on what happened the Sunday before. And we've got a column in that table of strength of schedule, you know, for all 17 games on your schedule. And the Patriots' strength of schedule is the only one that starts with the number three. It's right now 374, Ken. Everybody else is at least in the 400s or the 500s. That's a very easy schedule. And beyond just the teams that they played, there's another thing to consider here with the road that the Patriots have had this season being a rather easy road. Even though they're a team in the Northeast on the East Coast, they haven't had to go west of the Mississippi. Like, the three biggest road trips were Tennessee, New Orleans, and Tampa Bay. Like, their travel schedule was rather easy as well this season. And that is something that people identified early in the year. I remember there was a fascinating chart about strength of schedule and then mileage juxtaposed. I saw it on social media, and New England had the easiest path because they didn't have to travel a ton. Again, in the division, it's, you know, Miami, one road game to Miami. So I guess you factor in that game as well. But Buffalo's not a big trip. You know, certainly
did they go to Europe, New York City this year?
No.
Okay, that's really good. Yeah,
they went to Europe last year, but they didn't have a ton of travel as well. And so you have an easy schedule on paper, not a ton of travel as well. Again, Miami, Tampa Bay, Nashville, New Orleans, that's it. Like, as far as long road trips, it's been a very favorable schedule. Now, again, that's reflected. That isn't reflected in DVOA, but the teams they've played is reflected in DVOA. And that's why DVOA, which I, you know, like you, put a lot of stock and faith into, doesn't really believe in them yet, with good reason. Now, again, they beat Buffalo, probably, you know, arguably the toughest game on their schedule. Mm-hmm. Now, Tampa Bay, yes, you win that game on the road, but I don't think that's really a tough game. Then you lose to Buffalo. This game against Baltimore is probably their last chance for a sort of close an argument. And if you look at, say, juxtaposing the NFL with down a level of the NCAA and the FBS and the playoff selection committee, I'd compare them to like a James Madison, right? Like, it's not like they're a Alabama or an Ohio State. Like, they're a team that's probably needs a little help to get in, and they might be the 12 seed if you're stacking them that way, and might be one and done when we get there.
You have written the teaser for this, this episode.
There you go, right? Yeah, you go. The Patriots are the James Madison of the, of the 25 season. That works for me.
Take us through Drake May and what he brings to the offense. And a lot of people, I think, you know, in the Maryland area still don't really know him. I mean, obviously not in the division and did play in the ACC, but that's not where Maryland is anymore. So,
right. And I think, Ken, you could frame what he brings to this team in sort of three words: explosiveness, elusiveness, and escapability. Extra word there, and hope. Let's start with the explosiveness, right? You know, this is a league that right now centers so much in the idea of explosive plays, generating them on offense, taking them away on defense. Last year, this passing game, they had, I think, 34 explosive plays, pass plays of 20 yards or more. That is dead last in the NFL, tied with the New York Giants. This year, they've got 50 through the first 15 weeks of the season. That is fourth in the NFL. So that is a massive change in generating explosive plays in the passing game. Last year, Drake May himself, adjusted completion percentage of 36.7% on throws over 20 yards. That was 31st in the league. This year, 55.1%. Nice. That's fifth in the NFL. Again, kind of a massive jump in what they're doing in the downfield passing game, what they're doing to generate explosive plays in the passing game. And so that's a big part of it. There's also that escapability, right? Like, he gives you the ability to still generate positive, even explosive plays when he's pressured. An adjusted completion percentage this year of 71.1% when pressured, that's seventh in the NFL. That's
very good.
A completion percentage of 55% when pressured, that's sixth in the NFL. And what does that give you as a team, as an offense, as an offensive line? It gives you hope, right? It gives you that hope that, look, if I miss a block, if I miss a stunt, a twist, if we don't communicate it right and he gets pressured, he's going to still make up for it. He's going to cover my mistakes. That gives you the feeling that you want to go play for this guy, right? Yeah. You want to make a play for this guy. And so I'd say explosiveness, escapability, and hope.
I think, by the way, I think Ravens fans can really understand how the offensive line and Lamar Jackson have a similar relationship here in Baltimore in terms of that. Okay, so let's talk about the offensive line itself, because that has been, for a lot of the year, one of the strengths of the Patriots, right?
It has been. I think injuries are an issue right now, Ken. You've lost Will Campbell, their rookie left tackle. So now you've got Venarian Lowe stepping into that spot. They lost, you know, Jared Wilson, a third-round pick, who was their starting left guard for a couple weeks ago. He's come back. It's a solid group. I think it's a better run-blocking unit than a pass protection unit. Again, that gets us back to the previous point about May, where he can cover some of that up. But if you look at run-block win rate, both on a team basis and on an individual basis, you know, they're near the bottom of the league in that category. But in pass block win rate, they're near the bottom of the league. Run block win rate, though, you know, they're near the top of the league. They're 11th in the NFL in run block win rate as a unit. You know, it's a very good run blocking group. The pass protection element of it, again, May can cover some of that up. Something to note, they're a team that likes to use a sixth offensive lineman at times. You know, you're seeing Thayer Murford, number 74, come onto the field. He had, I think, 10 snaps last week against Buffalo in that game. And two of their, you know, their two long touchdown runs, the 52-yard TD, the 65-yard TD, both of those came, Ken, with a sixth offensive lineman on the field. And so that's something to note as well.
That's interesting because the Ravens just played the Steelers, who play a lot of OL6. They played Buffalo early in the year, plays a lot of OL6. Yeah. And the Ravens responded this last week to the Steelers, or I guess it was the week before last against the Steelers, having four active nose tackles, which I've never seen before for an NFL team. Those four guys weighed a combined 1,421 pounds, 355 each. And the Ravens may very well go back to that choice this week, because I don't think you want to line up against New England with the running game they've had with only four defensive linemen active, and that's really their major alternative.
It's a brand new world in the NFL right now, Ken, because for so many years, right, it's been getting light in the box, getting light up front, fast, agile, playing in space. This year, I mean, obviously the leaders in the clubhouse when it comes to getting bigger, the Rams, right? I mean, nobody runs more 13 personnel in the NFL right now than the Los Angeles Rams, but they're generating a ton of efficiency and productivity out of 13 personnel, especially when you look at EPA added both in the run game and the pass game out of 13 personnel. Teams like Buffalo, teams like Pittsburgh, teams like New England, they're getting bigger, more stuff with 12 personnel, more stuff with extra offensive linemen, six offensive linemen on the field. And so it's a new day in the NFL. We always sort of thought, given the cyclical nature of the game, right, where the counterweight to getting smaller and lighter once defenses caught up and did the same was get it big up front, bigger personnel packages. We're seeing that this year with teams like the Rams, teams like Buffalo, teams like the Steelers, and teams like the Patriots.
Yeah, well, for a lot of years, I think the trend was 11 personnel force the nickel. You're really forcing the other defense to get smaller. Now, point of attack football is back, and it's surprising because it's really not a bunch of teams going to any one particular strategy. Like the Ravens use a fullback, but they also use multiple tight ends. Other teams are, like you've said, have gone to six offensive linemen or multiple tight end formations to do it. So there's still some broad disagreement theoretically or schematically on how to do it best. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, like the Rams with 13 personnel, I mean, they've run this year, according to Sumer Sports, 213 plays out of 13 personnel, and they're averaging 0.46 expected points added per pass when they do it. I mean, they're throwing out of 13. They're getting the defense to respond with big personnel and then throwing to the tight ends out of it. I mean, it's fascinating to see. And then you get teams like, you know, New England that are using a variety of personnel packages. You've got obviously teams, you know, that throw a lot out of 12 or 21. You know, for years, San Francisco was often, you know, with Juszczyk and McCaffrey throwing out of 21 personnel. And so to see the various roadmaps teams have for offensive efficiency and, again, generating some explosive plays out of bigger personnel packages, it's one of the more fascinating aspects to this season.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know where the Ravens rank now. I mean, obviously, they're not as heavy as they used to be in the Roman era when they were the heaviest team. The combination of fullback, tight end, and OL6, those three players on the field in the Roman era, that the peak of it, they were at about 2.35 eligible receivers dedicated to those three groups per play. And you'll get five per play, folks. I mean, that's the basis of football. So it's really huge, but I'd be really interested to hear where they are now, because my numbers are showing that you know, they've been consistently in the high ones. They had one game over two this year, but they're probably still about 175, I would guess, 180 for the year, which I'd be really interested to know where that fits in the league this day. Maybe you're even, I could kind of sense you're even looking it up right now.
I mean, I'm just kind of looking up by personnel group. And I mean, Baltimore is still one of the league leaders in 12. Yeah. I mean, they've run, you know, 302 plays out of 12 personnel, which is fourth most, you know, in the National Football League. And then when you look at 21, you know, they're third, where they've run 113 plays out of 21 personnel. But again, it's not, you know, it used to be they were the league leaders in 12. They were the league leaders in 21. It's coming down a bit. They've run a little bit more 11 this year. So it's starting to balance a little bit more in Baltimore.
Okay. All right. Very good. Talk about some common plays in formation. Actually, talk about the receiving core first, because we passed them up.
Yeah, it's interesting. You think about Patriots receiving cores of the past, especially under Josh McDaniels, right? You think smaller slot receivers, Welker, Edelman, and things like that. They've added some size and verticality to this pass game. I mean, Mac Hollins at 6'4". You know, obviously, Kayshon Boutte isn't 6 feet. He's just under 5'11". They're bigger. They're doing more off the vertical stem on the outside, while, again, working in some stuff underneath. You know, they've got roles carved out for Douglas, roles carved out for Williams, more shiftier guys. Certainly, Stephon Diggs is a big element of what they do in the pass game, particularly on third downs. And we can talk about that a little more if you want. And then the tight ends, Henry and Hooper, are also core elements of what they do. In particular, Henry, there's a huge trust and communication element between Henry and May. And when you get to, say, 3rd and 4, 3rd and 5, 3rd and 7, those types of situations, you know, we could talk conceptually about what they do. But Drake May's eyes will go to May. I mean, they'll go to Diggs. They'll go to Hunter Henry. You know, that's where his mind goes in those sort of gotta-have-it situations. But it's a different sort of group than you might be used to seeing from New England, where the pass game would be run through the slot position. The pass game would be run through Welker or through Edelman. It's a lot different, and sort of conceptually, you're seeing a lot of vertical go ball to the weak side, where if he likes it, he'll alert it and throw it, and then a concept to the front side, where if he doesn't like the matchup on the single receiver vertical, or if he likes the concept more to the other side of the field, he'll throw the concept. And so it's different, even though it's still Josh McDaniels. It's still his, you know, it's still his playbook, which I got right here. Mm-hmm. They're just doing it differently, and it's made it a more fascinating study. And I think it's made it a more explosive offense, particularly in the downfield passing game.
All right. Outstanding stuff. Let's talk about maybe a couple of common plays they run, some signature play that May and Diggs or May and anybody have.
Yeah. I mean, in the pass game, there's a lot of what they like to do. Like I said, where you've got a go ball alerted to one side, weak side of the field, say a 3-by-1, where if May likes that, if he likes the matchup, he'll throw it. I mean, it doesn't take long to find examples of that. I mean, their first explosive play against Buffalo last week was that situation where they had Boutte matched up single receiver side, matched up against a corner, go ball to that side, and he threw that. But backside, he had sort of a levels concept where you've got, you know, a dig, you've got a shallow, you've got a post over the top of that. He could have thrown that concept, that layered concept to one side, but through the go sort of weak side. You know, against the Giants, same sort of situation where he threw the vertical to, you know, Kyle Williams, a rookie receiver out of Washington State. But backside, you had that sort of dagger concept. They call it indigo in their parlance, where you've got the go and then you've got the dig underneath, the dig underneath, a dagger concept, obviously a very popular concept in the NFL. And so you see a lot of that. With respect to Diggs, what they really like to do with him, in addition to stuff you'd expect, shallows, crossers, slants, things like that, breaking over the middle, they love to run with him what they call gaudy, which is outside receiver go, inside receiver, which will be Diggs running an option route. And he'll just really break off the leverage of a man coverage defender. He's got basically a three-way go, if you want to think of it. Defender plays him with outside leverage, he'll break inside. Defender plays him with inside leverage, he'll break outside. You get zone coverage, you'll just sit down and find grass against zone. So that's something that they really like to do with Diggs. And so when you get to, say, third down situations, you know, you might see a lot of stick, a concept that they really like. It's really part of their red zone package, but they do like to run it, say, in third down situations, is what they call Y toggle, where you've got it's a 3-by-1 look, a tight end, Hunter Henry is at that three alignment. Outside receivers, the one and the two will run what they call the return, where they show slant and break outside. And then Henry will run what they call that sort of toggle route, where he'll push more vertically, but again, break off the leverage of the nearest defender. A lot of the stuff in the McDaniels playbook, a lot of the stuff they do with Diggs and we do with Henry is option stuff where you're breaking off of leverage. And so pass game wise, that's a lot of the stuff that they like to do, particularly with Diggs and Henry, is giving them options, giving them two or three way goes and letting them be on the same page with May and just reading out what the defense gives them and taking what the defense is willing to give up.
Okay. All right. That's a great description, by the way. And in terms of gravitational impacts on the safeties that they would do, you're talking about leverage off of oftentimes the man or underneath defender you're talking about. But in terms of what they do to gravitationally impact the safeties, who's their go-to guys for that?
I mean, a lot of it is Diggs. And, you know, some of the stuff that I just described, you know, tendencies with Diggs, maybe more third down. But even with Diggs, in the deeper stuff, they're going to use them on a lot of dig routes. And maybe there's a subconscious Diggs thing going there with McDaniels. I don't know. But you see him, Diggs and posts are how they're going to sort of pull defenders, pull safeties, particularly if you're getting those split high looks that we know a lot of teams are running right now. You get those safeties to come inside on those because you're worried about Stephon Diggs on a dig route or a post route, which again frees up a lot of what they like to do on those one-on-one routes. And again, coming back to how we sort of began this portion of the discussion, where you've got a concept to one side, a vert on the other, you know, they'll pair a post route as part of a concept to front side, get the safeties to come downhill, squeeze the middle of the field to take away a post throw to Diggs or Henry, and then you throw.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, this is Steve Gorman, radio host, sports commentator, former drummer for the Black Crowes. The winter holidays are here, a time for festive celebrations, family gatherings, and ringing in the new year. Whether it's a holiday party, a night out with friends, or just relaxing by the fire with a few drinks, it's a season full of good cheer. But here's something else to add to your holiday plans, a safe and sober ride home. Just like in sports and music, always have a game plan. And the most important part of any plan is sticking to it. If you plan to drink, take that plan a step further. Call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or have a designated driver lined up before the night begins. Drinking and driving is a decision that can change your life and the lives of others forever. A DUI, a crash, an injury, the consequences are real and lasting. So please, for your sake and for everyone else on the road, make the smart choice. Get a sober ride home. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.
Throw that go ball where now the safeties can't get over, will get over late because of it. And so that's how they sort of stress those safeties, particularly against open field looks where you get Diggs or on a post or a dig, or you get Henry on a seam. You know, May has no hesitation throwing, you know, that traditional seam route to the tight end against a split safety look, squeeze those guys infield, then you throw the go routes outside.
Okay, so that's great complementary use of receivers there. In terms of the individual thing, what you mentioned about Diggs, having the dig and post being his complementary route structure. This is interesting because the Ravens have, you know, a former teammate in Tez Walker of Mays, and his big thing coming out of college, and the reason he dropped all the way to the fourth round, I think, is because he didn't really have the complementary set of return routes, a dig or a comeback on the sideline or whatever it might be, that went with his outstanding 7, 8, 9 packages that he could run. Obviously Stephon Diggs far ahead, but I think that's been one of the nice things about Tez Walker is he's made advances this year in terms of coming back for the football that have allowed him to be used, be more effective on some deep shots they've taken. And it's not like he's had a lot of targets or anything. It's just,
right.
We're kind of excited about, you know, where this may
be
leading.
Yeah.
All right, let's flip over the defensive side for a second. The first thing I always like to ask is how do the Patriots typically line up on third down? Do they play a dime package or do they have a specific like 3rd and 7, 3rd and 8 package they like to run?
I mean, at the outset, it's important to note they're one of the bigger sub-package teams. You know, it's mostly 4-2-5. You know, they'll get smaller than that, but you're talking about a defense that is in some kind of sub-package 78% of the time, which is eighth most in the NFL. Like, they want to be, for the most part, in 4-2-5. That's where they like to be because they like particularly their three corners in that 4-2-5 group, because you've got Christian Gonzalez, who's up there in the upper echelon, say, of cornerbacks. You've got veteran Carlton Davis, again, on the other side, on the outside. And you've got Marcus Jones, who they love in the slot. They really like the two safeties that they got. Mm-hmm. And that gives them some flexibility up front with the four-man surface that they run out there. But when it comes to 12 and 21, while they're still happy to live in 4-2-5 against those packages, I think what's instructive is last week against Buffalo, though, you saw some base 4-3. You saw even some 3-4 stuff where they would have the outside backers walked up. So it's more of that five-man surface against 12 and 21, which is looking more like a Pop Warner, say, old-school 5-2. And so they want to be, for the most part, and they have been for the most part, in those sub-packages, primarily, again, 4-2-5. But 3-4 with a five-man surface, you know, 4-3 with three off-ball linebackers, it's something you saw a lot more of last week against Buffalo. And I think that's something to keep in mind going into this game against Baltimore, where they like to be. You might see more of these bigger packages on the field. You might see, again, that 3-4 personnel grouping with a five-man surface.
Okay, so I'm with you on the sort of front they show, and I'm with you on the the concept of a 4-2-5 and what that means, but it's what the two are that to me is always the big decision. Is it a Mike linebacker who's got the green dot? And I don't know who's wearing the green dot for New England this year, but is the second player a weak side linebacker on first and second down, and then they bring in a safety on third down, like a lot of teams do, like the Ravens do, frankly. Or are they satisfied with a committed nickel look where they're going to a second inside linebacker off ball on the normal set of passing downs?
Yeah. And it's a very timely question, because traditionally they've have been happy this year with two linebackers on the field in that 4-2-5, mm-hmm. you know, Spillane being one, and, you know, there's been some sort of rotation at the sort of other linebacker spot. Spillane's kind of their green dot guy, but then you're looking at, say, more of an Ellis or a Tavai. You know, depending on situation, Tavai's more early down type of guy, Alice more of your later down, or Mapu, your later down passing situation kind of guy. Why I say it's timely is Spillane showed up with a walking boot in the locker room just an hour ago. He missed last week's game. He showed up with a foot injury on the injury report on Thursday, participated in the pregame stuff, but then was held out. And so now you've got an injury situation to consider. Now, Jack Gibbons was the guy that sort of took those snaps over. He played a season-high 71 snaps. He's more of your every down, you know, leave him on the field, Spillane-type replacement. But that's something to watch if we see more of an extra safety on the field and third down next to Gibbons. Or how do they handle that without Spillane if, as we're sitting here on Wednesday afternoon with a walking boot on, seems like he might be out this weekend. And so that's something to keep in mind headed into Sunday night. So like I said, for the most part, they're happy being two linebackers in a sub package on a third and eight situation, that they're comfortable doing that when Spillane's on the field. Will that comfort continue if he's out and he doesn't even dress? And now you've had a couple of days to game plan for it. Will it still be two linebackers with now one of your, you know, backup linebackers, or are you going to see maybe a safety in that spot? How are they going to handle that going forward?
Well, they traded Kyle Duggar at midseason to the Steelers, of course, and he'd be a guy.
He'd be a guy that you would plot it, you know, slide into that situation. You'd kind of like to have him for this game now if Spillane's out. Now they're going to have to figure it out going forward.
Okay. All right. How about rotation and snap management up front on the defensive line? Who do they rotate, and who are their primaries for pass and run?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, look, Tonga, you know, and Durden, they're your rotational run stopper guys. Barbour is your more every down type of guy. He's on the field 65% of the time. They'll spell him for, you know, breaks and, you know, let him get his win back. But he's their sort of more every down guy. You know, Tonga, he's more of your run-stop guy. Durden, more of your sort of get him on the field for more passing situations. Farmer, he played – Josh Farmer, he played a season-high 34 snaps against Buffalo. You might see a little bit more of him in this game on Sunday night. They like him in sort of bigger personnel packages like Buffalo runs, like Baltimore runs. So you might see a little bit more of him. On the edges, you know, Chase Arnold Landry are their primary you know, pass rushers off the edge. Those are your edge guys that they'd like to have the field on the field for the most part, but they'll work jet ends in on third and long situations. They'll work Ponder in on third and long situations. You know, they've tried to keep those guys fairly fresh. I mean, Jennings has only played, I think, 26% of their snaps. Ponder just 16% of their snaps. They rely on the two, Chase on and Landry, but they've spelled them in spurts, but they want to have those two guys on the field for the most part.
Okay, let's go back to Christian Barmore for a second, because one of my real favorites coming out in the 21 draft, and a guy who was really one of the only good linemen, one of the only good defensive linemen coming out in a very thin draft of defensive linemen.
Class that year, yeah.
And a terrific player his first 3 years. I guess, when did the Patriots extend him? After three or after four? When did they do it?
I believe it was after three. I think they extended him early just because, look, he lived up to expectations. I mean, he was a – I mean, I remember right into that draft cycle, and, you know, you sort of mentioned that there, Ken, it was a very thin defensive tackle class, and I knew Bill Belichick was going to draft him. I mean, Alabama guy, Saban ties, thin position group, you get the best guy. It was the quintessential Patriots pick, and he sort of lived up to their expectations, which is why I think they extended him early, and he's
What's
a big
happen
part
the last
of what
two
they
years?
Do.
I know that's true, and it's still he's central to their defense, and all of the snaps played are very obvious. He just hasn't been as productive the last couple of years. Kind of, can you take us through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is this defense wasn't good the past couple of years, and coming into this season, this defense was a huge question mark, and it took a big step forward this year. Obviously, having the cap space they did, the ability to go out and, you know, pay premium price tags for players like a Milton Williams, who's been out since, you know, getting hurt in week 11. You know, obviously if he were back for this one, it'd be super helpful, but he won't be. The defense wasn't good overall. And, you know, he was a very good player along a weaker defensive front. And so you ran away from him. You know, if you're an offensive coordinator last year facing New England, you would run away from Barmore. You would throw away from Barmore. You would slide protection on his way on the inside because not too many other people scared you, which is why production maybe dipped a little bit. But now, because they've got better players on the edges, because they've got, you know, they had Milton Williams for the first 10 full games of the season alongside of them, you know, you had to worry about more things. I always love to frame things, discussions like this one, you know, who are you worried about as an offensive coordinator going up against this defense? Last year was Barmore and Gonzalez, and that was it. You know, you could scheme around that. This year, you know, early in the year, you had to worry about Williams. You had to worry about Barmore. You had to worry about Gonzalez and Davis and Jones. And you had to worry about other guys on the edges too with Landry and Chase. And so there was more to contend with. You couldn't answer all the problems. So it's made it more productive for Barmore this year.
Okay. Great, great stuff. They've had some trouble stopping the run in recent weeks. Can you take us through what's kind of happened?
Yeah, that's a big issue. That's a massive issue headed into this game. And it's not like teams have just figured out, oh, we can run counter, we can run outside zone. They can't stop anything right now. And, you know, part of it is losing Williams. You know, he was a big part of stopping the run on the inside. But you're talking about a defense that until week four, look, they didn't give up 100 yards on the ground until week four against Carolina. That was the first time they did it. They did it again the following week against, you know, they gave up 5 yards, I mean, more than 100 yards in week five. Then it was another stretch of games where you had four games in a row, 4 weeks in a row, an offense didn't hit 100 yards. But then Williams goes down, you know, week 11 against the Jets. You give up 140 yards on the ground that game. 120 against a Joe Flacco Bengals team where you had to expect they were going to run the football. 111 against Jackson Dart and the Giants in the game. You won, you know, 33-15. Like that should have been a one-dimensional, they were going to have to throw it situation, but they could still run the ball. And then 168 coming out of the bye against Buffalo. And part of that, I think, was game scripts relevant in a scenario because Buffalo seemed to have the ball the entire second half. But Buffalo was also down 24-7 at the half in the first play of the second half. You give up an 11-yard run, Ken. Like, they can't stop the run right now. And that's why in the second half of that game, you know, I mentioned that first run of the first half. it was one of those 3-4 personnel plays with a 5-man surface, and you give up an 11-yard run to James Cook on the first play of the second half.
Right. So they've really three down linemen in the game.
You got three down linemen in the game. You've got two edge rushers on the edges. Mm-hmm. You've got, again, that 5-man surface with three interior defensive tackles, and it's an inside run and play, and you give up 11 yards. Like, your laughter gives away the game, right? Yeah. Like, they can't figure out a way to consistently stop the run right now. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a problem Sunday night. And so what can they do? You can get Milton Williams back, but now you might be without Spillane, who's the green dot, heart and soul of your defense and your second level. It's going to be a situation that could pose problems. It's going to be a storyline to watch as they say, get into the playoffs. And if you see some of these teams, if you see a Buffalo again, if you see other teams that can run the football, it's going to be a problem they're going to have to sort out if they want to have the kind of playoff run they're hoping for.
This has been a pretty good tackling team this year. I look at the PFF grades. I know they're fairly draconian on missed tackles, so like their missed tackles force numbers. But the Patriots have been one of the better tackling teams, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's sort of that Belichick-Vrabel coaching tree of, look, it's an easy game, right? You think back to that incredible documentary with Saban and Belichick, and there's that story Belichick told of, you know, they lose a game and he gets on the bus and all the number crunchers are going over data in the first two rows of the bus. He's like, guys, put the laptops away. We lost because we couldn't tackle. Like, it's an easy game. You see the ball, you hit the ball, you get the guy to the ground. It's something they stress from the first day of training camp. It's something they stress in practice to this point of the season is tackle. And so, yes, they've been a good tackling team, but the problem in recent weeks has been, you know, particularly that Bills game, when the first contact is 7 yards downfield, you can tackle to your heart's content. You're giving up an 8-yard run. And so, winning at the point of contact, winning in the trenches these next couple of weeks of the regular season and into the playoffs, that's a huge story because they can tackle phenomenally well. But when that tackle comes 8 yards downfield because you're getting shoved off the ball, you're giving up chunk plays. You're not going to win football games. Doesn't matter how good you can tackle.
All right. We had one great question come in from a listener over the last couple of days here. And it's something I really don't know the answer to, but you're the one who would know. Have the Patriots played a lot of inverted cover two this year defensively? And tell me a little bit about what, you know, what exactly that means. I looked out on AI is telling me stuff. And by the way, this is a funny story. I'll let you kind of look up what you're looking up because I know you're going to take a second here. I have an offensive line scoring system, as you probably know. And, yep. And I looked up like what my offensive line scoring system was because I was trying to find the podcast where I defined it. And then Google AI comes back with this scoring system that's completely not mine. It's hilarious. I mean, it's just, oh, it's -1 for this, it's +2 for this kind of thing. I'm like, that's not it.
Right. I mean, trust but verify when it comes to Google AI, right? Like that's how you sort of frame that. First of all, that's a brilliant question. I love that somebody asked about inverted cover two because it gives me a chance to rant for a second about never run inverted two. Like, just don't do it. And what inverted two is you can get there a couple of different ways. Your finishing product is a cover two deep defenders coverage scheme, okay? But why I say two deep defenders and not two deep safeties is you're getting there from a different way, right? You might show, say, cover four, where you've got four deep across the secondary, say, two outside corners deep, and your two safeties deep. But you get to that two deep where those safeties might come down underneath, and now your two deep defenders are not safeties but corners. So you're getting to that same two deep structure, but doing it with different personnel groups. And why I don't like when defenses run cover two, it's the quickest way to give up a big play. It's like that old adage about, you know, a prevent defense prevents you from winning the game because you're just giving the offense opportunities to make big plays. Because now what you're getting is typically players that aren't half field defenders for the most part, corners, you know, maybe you're going to be really wild and do it with a linebacker. Mm-hmm. Now they're playing in that half field role. They're not as comfortable. They don't do it often enough as your traditional safeties. And at the same time, you know, you're rotated right at the snap, which gives you a lot of moving parts. And any experienced quarterback might see that rotation and punish you for it. And so it's a quick way to try to confuse a quarterback. But at this point, you're not confusing a lot of quarterbacks when you run it. Quarterbacks have seen all this stuff before. You might, you know, fool a rookie or a younger quarterback, but you know, you're probably not going to fool most quarterbacks. And most quarterbacks that have been around the league for now, say, two full seasons, like Drake May, you know, you're not going to fool them. From the Patriots' perspective, you're not fooling Lamar Jackson. He's seen every inverted cover two look you can throw at an NFL quarterback at this point in his career. So that's kind of what inverted two is. That's kind of why I hate running it. It's, you know, the film people like you and I can, you know, when we see cover two, we probably snicker because we know what's coming. It's probably a big play. Now, to the Patriots, they're not a big cover two team. Just 57 snaps overall of cover two. And I think only like 16 of those are some sort of invert. And when I say invert, it's maybe not a full invert where you're getting two people. It might even just be a half invert where you're getting one person to sort of roll back at the snap. And so it's not something they do a ton of. And I'm thankful for that because I don't like it when my teams do it. I just think it's a way to give up a big play. You're not confusing too many people.
That is absolutely the best single answer to a hashtag film study mailbag question the entire year. Please contribute them still, but Mark, outstanding. I always finish by asking for one player on each side of the ball that you think matches up well against what the Ravens present.
We'll start defense, and maybe it's not such that he matches up well against what the Ravens present, although I do think there's an element here to that. I think he matches up anybody, and that's Christian Gonzalez. He is such a joy to watch play the cornerback position, and he gives you numbers flexibility on the defensive side of the ball. And what I mean by that is he's your prototypical set and forget corner, right? Mm-hmm. This is where you're going to be. This is who you're going to cover. We're not going to worry about you. We'll worry about the other 10 defenders on the field and what we can do. You don't have to worry about him. I heard his name called once in that Bills game. It was on one of the very first plays of the game. They targeted him, and I felt like you didn't see him the rest of the game. He's a set-and-forget type corner. And so whatever they decide to do with him on Sunday night, whether they put him on, you know, one receiver or another receiver, doesn't matter. I'm not too worried about where he's going to be. I'm not worried about him giving up a big play. And so Gonzalez stands out to me in that respect. And it might be big because, you know, you might have to commit an extra body into the box to stack against the run. So you might not have a situation where the safeties can give you too much help. So at least if you have a set and forget type corner in a game like this, that gives me a little bit of hope. That gives me a little bit of comfort. On the offensive side of the ball, look, the easy answer would be May, but I think Trayvon Henderson has been massive for this team. And I'll fold in Stevenson as well. You know, two-headed tandem at the running back position. It's almost a Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside element to call back the old Army days, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that Army team with the two running backs that they had back in the 40s. And, you know, might be dating myself here, but I remember Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside from reading about them growing up as a kid. They've got that sort of element with Stevenson, your more downhill type runner. They like him in between the tackles. Henderson's giving them some explosive run plays. Now, obviously, the two long touchdown runs this past weekend against Buffalo, had a huge long touchdown run against Tampa Bay that was big in that game. He's given them, you know, some explosiveness in the run game. They like both of those guys in the pass game as well. They like Stevenson on angle routes. They like Henderson out of the backfield too. I really like what those guys bring to the table. And I think on a night like Sunday night, when you might want to ball control a bit, you might want to extend drives, you know, with the pass game and the backs and the run game as well. Those two guys, I think, are key to potentially going into Baltimore and stealing a win.
There's teaser number two, Doc Blanchard and Glenn Davis, Mr. Inside.
There you go, right? I had Glenn Davis. I wasn't quite there with pulling Doc Blanchard out of the background, but you had it for me. Ken, appreciate that.
Well, those Army and Navy games during wartime were fantastic. All the talent in the whole college ranks were
yeah, I mean, that's where it was.
Yeah. All right. Mark, just a pleasure to have you on again. Thank you so much for coming on. Tell folks where they can find your work.
Well, Ken, I was so excited when you reached out the other day because I've been dying to do one of these shows again. And so to see that, you know, notification pop up on Twitter, that you were reaching out for this one, I was so happy to hear it. And I was so excited. Like I said, I was telling some coworkers, I got up at 6 this morning, saw the list of questions, started jotting down the answers. It gave me a chance to, again, dust off the 2016 Patriots playbook that I'm holding up here for everybody, that McDaniels playbook, to pull out some of the concepts as well. So I was so excited to hop
this
on.
This is an audio-only podcast, but that's okay. We appreciate it. I can verify.
For everybody that can, for Ken, who can see it right here. There you go, that playbook. You know, you can find me on X at Mark Schofield, on Blue Sky at Mark Schofield. I think it's Mark Schofield 3916 or 030916 on Threads, trying to cover all the social media bases. But the easiest way, Ken, SBNation.com. You'll see me all over the place. You know, since we chatted last, I'm now a Formula One writer, Ken. In
my
addition
God.
To all the NFL stuff, I'm an F1 writer.
I'm interviewing Lando Norris. I'm down in Austin.
You know, I'm covering races at the racetrack. I'm interviewing Lewis Hamilton 20 minutes after he spins out at Austin last year. It's been a fascinating, wild journey. You know, interviewing, you know, for those listeners to the show that might be F1 fans, interviewing Zach Brown, interviewing Toto Wolff, interviewing Christian Horner. I mean, and maybe, just maybe, next year's, you know, season of Drive to Survive, you might even see me in one of those episodes. And so it's been a fun little journey, Ken, but deep, you know, near and dear to my heart, as the accent gives away, I'm a huge Patriots fan. And so to talk about the Patriots for an hour like this on a show that I absolutely love, with somebody who I love chopping it up with, it's been an absolute joy.
Now, I know one of the things we had was that your son, you call him the little traitor.
An update to the little traitor. The little traitor is now a freshman in high school at Wooten High School here in Montgomery County, alma mater of Mac Hollins. And he had a big announcement just a couple weeks ago. He's going to be a Patriots fan too now. And what's really funny, Ken, is, you know, we're in Montgomery County, Maryland. A lot of his buddies, they're like, no, you're a traitor to us now. So they've been quizzing him on who the Patriots players are. Ken, he came into, I'm in our living room right now doing this. You can see the Schofield family Christmas tree here. Mm-hmm. He came into the living room the other day and he sat down. He's like, Dad, I've been testing myself. I've been studying. I'm ready. He's like, ask me any Patriots player. So I was going like position by position, because he had to prove to his buddies now, a lot of whom are on the, you know, the JV football team. You know, he's, you know, Owen's a baseball player, but you know, his buddies on the football team were like, you don't know who the players are. So he's like, you know, ask me who the backup, ask me who the slot corner is, ask me who wide receiver three is. He's like rattling off the name. So he still has a very soft spot for Lamar Jackson. He has Jackson jerseys in the closet. He loves Lamar Jackson. He likes the Ravens, but he's warmed up to the Patriots. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, very good. I it's always nice to be able to watch football with your dad. That's something I never enjoyed, because dad was not a football fan. But
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's those. Yeah, I do enjoy Sundays and, you know, Monday nights, and, you know, he'll turn on the games before I do. And it's been fun this season watching it with him.
All right. Other folks out there, thanks so much for listening. Hit us up with hashtag Film Study Mailbag. We've got great guests who can answer these questions. I'll do my best to put it on the proper show, whether it's the offense show, the defense show, Know Your Foe like this one, or on the Friday morning jam show, where a lot of questions come up about the Ravens roster mechanics and whatnot. Mark, thanks again for coming on.
Ken, thanks so much for having me.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study. All right. Outstanding.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.